Yeah, so next week's talk is Frank Antonius, talking about work that has been a long time coming, like 20 or 25 years, that one could have a good talk about simulations of binary black hole mergers. This has been a goal of research for a long time, and the story is that apparently now there are some good, I've heard characterized as spectacular results, and he's going to come and tell us about them. The fact that the room is crowded is a testimony to Jim, who's our visiting speaker today. Jim hardly needs much of an introduction. He's been hugely influential in quantum cosmology, foundations of quantum mechanics, general relativity, and some other topics between. He even has some papers on the notion of time that the first people don't mention. Yeah, that was supposed to be time, but it's true. And it's a great, great pleasure to have him visiting us this week. I know he's been having a chance to talk to many people, but if the other people would like to talk to him, he's here all week and in that corner of the fourth floor. And today he's going to be, as he was saying, he gave us an option of a safe topic, and this topic, which is the most, probably the most important question that many of us think about, which is whether and how quantum mechanics can be extended to space-time and cosmology.
Thank you, Lee. It's a pleasure, I have to say, to be back. I'm not working for a living, so to speak, participating in the science and advising about it. A little while ago, I was asked to speak someplace else on this question. Does quantum mechanics actually apply to space-time? Here's my answer. So, it does, but the usual textbook formulations of quantum theory have to be generalized a little bit to make this application. And it's that is the subject of the Now, first, let's talk a little bit about quantum mechanics. There are three facets about the history of quantum theory that strike me, at any rate. The first is that quantum mechanics is probably the most successful of all physical theories, past or present, right, in terms of the scope of the phenomenon that it describes and the quantitative accuracy with which such descriptions are available. But despite this extraordinary success, many of our most brilliant minds have sought to replace it in some way. Einstein, Schrodinger, and of course I left out the brilliant minds from your institute. And yet, despite some of the most brilliant minds thinking that the theory should be replaced in some way, after 70 or 80 years, I did so, right, in my humble opinion, in hopes to stay on the web. There is no viable alternative to quantum mechanics. It fits well with the rest of physics, special relativity, quantum field theory. So I know that people in the room rejected it. Quantum mechanics has made a lot of progress, especially on experimental scales. Right? Many things, for example, that were once described in textbooks are now familiar experimental results. Here's the famous two-slit experiment, right, in which you have an electron gun at the screen, goes through two holes, and produce this interference pattern on the screen, which is characteristically phenomenal. Evidence for superposition. And here's the results, which are not showing up very well on this. It's getting better. What you see, right, in the experiment is, was one electron comes by, you see one dot here. And gradually, right, the classic interference pattern is emerged. So things that were on the textbook examples. Right. and are now being realized in the laboratory, and the range in which the characteristic quantum mechanical interference phenomenon can be exhibited, right, has been extended. Here's just an example from the Zeininger group. Here's the two-slit experiment, not the two-slit experiment, this is the many-slit experiment. This is done with the Talbot-Lau interferometer. This biological molecule, tetraphenyl porphyrin, if I pronounce it right, molecule. And here's the interference pattern between the molecule and the exhibited scale. So that's a large, fairly large physical system. Maybe the record holder at the moment, because the experiment's reasonably long, in superconducting squibs, in which, oops, that was a mistake. Oh, there. let's see. I laid my hand on this control panel in the rotation.
Right.
Maybe you could shrink it as well as it's too little.
Could I shrink it?
No, it's a good sign.
The zoom.
Posi negative.
Right, what does that mean?
That's it. Keep on
learning.
Is that too much? No, that's good. Can you bring it up?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect, thank you. Anyway, you have a superconducting swim. Right, threaded by a magnetic field because an integral made out of the apple, and here it's quantized. The flux through the loop is also quantized. If you drive the system as they did in halfway in between two levels, then you put it in the superposition, and alternate levels of the flux corresponding to large currents which are going around in opposite directions. And so they can, from spectroscopy, they can see evidence for the superposition, and it's a superposition where you're talking about 10 to the 10 magnetons. So we're getting up there to sort of something that might ultimately look like this. We haven't yet done this experiment. But in principle, there doesn't seem to be an obstacle to that. Therefore, it's as big as an extrapolation it is, there seems to be very reason to extrapolate quantum mechanics to the whole closed system of the universe itself and to the smallest possible scales, the scales of quantum gravity. So there have been many approaches for alternatives. I won't try to elaborate on these, including what's been done here, Ohmian mechanics, fundamental noise, the host ideas of determinism, the mean quantum theory, non-theories like Adler's relativity, so it's deterministic, but it's so non-commutative that you can't tell the difference between the quantum mechanics and the system. But I could assume just playing quantum mechanics here, try to modestly generalize the theory to deal with the issues that are less than gravity. So a familiar question, which is certainly a subject of the Fermat Institute, is the question of how our ideas about quantum mechanics affect our understanding of space-time. That's the problem of quantum gravity. I want to ask a different question, it's related, which is how do our ideas of space-time affect our understanding of quantum mechanics? Opposite. I'm not talking about a commitment of any particular theory of quantum gravity, but of the general quantum mechanical framework, which is necessary for any theory. Now, certainly, ordinary quantum mechanics incorporates assumptions about space and time. For example, if you just write down the Schrödinger equation, I e sin et equals h sin, two laws of evolution of quantum mechanics, first, it involves t. But what is t? Right? T is a metrical notion that defines distance in time-like directions. It's well-defined, but the space-time geometry is well-defined. So already, ordinary quantum mechanics, as we write it down, incorporates essentially the notion that the space-time geometry is fixed enough and integrated to define the time of existence, the Schrödinger equation. The so-called second evolution, the notorious evolution, notorious wave function reduction of the wave packet, says that on measurement, right, the wave function is reduced by being projected on the outcome of the measurement and then normalized, that's also involves time, because the action of this projection seems to take place all across some space-like surface, i.e. at one moment. So it involves a notion of space and time here. Now, that's quantum mechanics, non-relativistic theory. Our ideas of space-time, of course, have evolved over the period between the time of Newton and now. And correspondingly, our ideas about space-time, about quantum mechanics have evolved. So here's a brief history of space-time, starting with Newton. We had the idea of space plus one absolute time dimension, as it was called. By 1905, we have special relativity, where we have finite directions, but we have many different finite directions. By the time you have general relativity in 1915, you have the idea that the simple causal structures that are associated with special relativity, or the vast light cone, can have interesting properties, such as when you have a collapsing star forming a black hole and making the event horizon. And moving onward,
could you repeat what is the simultaneity, Jim?
Simultaneity,
yes.
Singularity, this is what this is. So the singularity formed on the inside. By 1955, you have a new sort of problem, new sort of big evolutionary idea. It's about space time, quantum space time. It's the idea that the space time is no longer fixed, but a quantum mechanical variable that is fluctuating quantum mechanically. So you don't know, in general, even what the two points are space time separated on time separated, because roughly speaking, in quantum mechanics, I expect some over different geometry to find them. So if you have 2 points on the manifold in one geometry, they might be time-like separated, and another geometry, they might be space-like separated.
Can you explain the date?
Well, that's roughly Dirac's first date in the center. If you're going to argue with that, you
don't depend on it's just an education. I'm just going
to. What's wrong with Einstein's 1916?
I'm not going to comment further on this. Try to defend this statement. By 1974, we have string theory, M theory, and the quantum theory of geometry. Right? Space time is not maybe not even be a basic variable. So we're certainly going to have to generalize what we had in the Schrodinger equation. History of the generalizations. We started off in non-relativistic quantum mechanics with the Newtonian theory, where the time was just the time of the absolute Newtonian time, and that's what the Schrodinger equation involves, and that's what the very much reduced. In special relativity, there are many different time-like directions, but they're also essentially equivalent, because you can pick any one direction, and then do the quantum mechanics of the theory in terms of the Schrodinger equation, and then the results are unitarily equivalent to any other choice. If you're sufficiently old, you read field theory books that had a chapter that said quantizing the theory, the Lorentz frame, and then the quantum mechanics, and then the next chapter was proving the Lorentz invariance of the theory, where they proved that you made any difference which choice you made. But by the time of 1915, when we had quantum field theory in curved space-time, so our general relativity, we can do the quantum mechanics by picking one family of space-like surfaces to be the time and Schrodinger equation, but the results are not generally unitarily equivalent to that of any choice. You have to make a fundamental choice there. What is the preferred time in the theory? And by the time we have quantum gravity, we have what classical relativists would have called the problem of time. That is, what replaces the Schrodinger equation? if the space-time is no longer fixed, the supply you need with the notion of t. And of course, if space-time is not even a basic variable for certain, we have to modify it. So we need some generalization of quantum mechanics to deal with quantum space-time. But there's another reason that we need a generalization of quantum mechanics, which has to do with cosmology, the fact that we live in a closed system. The usual formulations of quantum mechanics, open-ended formulations, for example, make certain assumptions. Right? They assume that measurements were the primary output or the thing that you needed to predict in probabilities for. They assume that the measurements were carried out by observers, and they assume that in one way or another, the quasi-classical realm of everyday experience. But in the theory of the whole thing, cosmology, there can't be any fundamental division into apparatus and measured substance, into observer and observed. It's fundamental to the theory. Observers and measurements can't be the fundamental way of, in a theory that seeks to describe the real universe, and plausibly, neither measurements nor observers existed much more than say, a million years ago, in physical outside. And there's no reason in a quantum mechanical system to assume that there'd be any variables that behave classically in all circumstances. So we already need a generalization of quantum mechanics just to apply to the closed system that is the universe, even if we assume that space-time is fixed. And the thesis of this part is the generalization needed for to deal with the fact that space-time is not fixed is connected with that necessary for cosmology. So that means I have to review for you a little bit the modern quantum mechanics of closed systems, most generally the universe, assuming space-time is fixed. Now, I did this yesterday for the quantum foundations group, right? And so they will just have to forgive me, but as a practical defense, I'm going to go 10 times as fast as I did yesterday. So I'll talk a little bit about the modern quantum mechanics of closed systems through Everett, Smith, Griffiths, Gell-Mann, right, and a bunch of other people. And that, what we're going to assume is that we have a universe with the most general objective of any quantum theory of the closed system is to predict the probabilities for coarse-grained alternative histories of the system. So, for example, we might be interested in the motion of the Earth around the Sun. Of course, in classical physics, it goes around our Kepler in orbit, right? But sometimes it could take any orbit it chooses, right? It's only that we hope that in the situations represented by the solar system, that the probability for the Keplerian orbit is much, much higher than the orbit for any non-classical. We're dealing with situations which are coarse-grained because in studying the orbit of the Earth, we're not talking about the describing all the variables in the universe, but typically just the Earth's center of mass. It's 10 to the 8 to the 1. Right? We're not talking about describing the position of the center of mass to arbitrary accuracy, because we don't have that accuracy to determine the, determine the orbit experimentally. And we're not talking about describing the orbit in a continuous series of times, but rather some series of times that correspond to the astronomical observations. But for those three reasons, the orbits are coarse-grained, which are typically used. But there's an obstacle to assigning probabilities to histories in quantum mechanics, and that's quantum interference. That's nowhere more clearly illustrated than the famous two-slit experiment. On the two-slit experiment, if you have an electron gun here, and a screen with an upper slit and a lower slit, and another screen where the electrons are detected arriving at some various points y on the screen, exhibit the characteristic of the interference pattern, then you can't assign probabilities to the alternative histories where the electron goes through the upper slit and arrives at y, and the electron went, or the electron went through the lowest that could arrive to one, because it would be inconsistent to do so. The usual probability sum rules, but the probability of arrive at y should be the sum of the probability to go through the upper slick and arrive at y, plus the probability to go through the lower slick and arrive at y, wouldn't be satisfied. It's not that you don't know which slick went through. It's inconsistent to assign the probabilities in this way. And that's because in quantum mechanics, probabilities are squares of amplitudes, and the sum of the squares is just not equal to the square of the sum. So some rules need to determine which sets of histories, alternative histories of the closed system, can be assigned probabilities and which cannot. In the usual Copenhagen's theory, the rule was you could assign histories to situations that were measured, because if you measured which slit the upper, or whether it went through the upper slit or not, then the interference was destroyed, the sum was evaded, and everything was fine. And if you didn't measure it, who cared? But that's the kind of rule which we cannot have in the quantum mechanics of cosmology, because it assumes certain measurements, systems, identity parts, and so forth. So the generalization of the rule is quite simple. As Griffiths on this little man again, probabilities can be assigned to just those sets of alternative histories of the closed system, in which the interference is negligible. In fact, it's a consequence of the closed system's initial quantum state, right, and its dynamics. Now, I want to describe, that's the general idea. Measurements can be described, but they don't play a fundamental role. I just want to describe this in a little bit more detail. To do that, I'm going to have to describe for you in a little bit more detail what the histories are, and a little bit more detail what we mean by the measure of interference between the histories. So, following what I said in the beginning, for this exposition, I'm going to neglect quantum space-time, assume the space-time geometry is fixed. This is an excellent approximation in the first 10 minutes and 30 seconds of the universe, and it has the advantage, as far as presenting this, that I can assume the usual apparatus of Hilbert space states, different equations, and so on, can be applied. So I'm assuming we're dealing with a large closed box, say, many thousands of megaparsecs on a side, but it contains everything, galaxies, stars, and the Earth, observers and observed, if any. There's nothing left out of the box, and we have to describe it in the system. One of the theoretical inputs I will assume are just the Hamiltonian of the system and the initial state, both given by theories. Theory of the wave function of the universe, perhaps Hawking's wave function of the universe here, and perhaps the Hamiltonian of quantum gravity, couple of that. So three ingredients are needed to define the quantum mechanics of such closed systems. The first is the notion of fine-grained histories, which are the most refined description of the system possible. Then there's the notion of coarse-grained histories, which I described a little bit in my example about the Earth, which are partitions of the fine-grained histories into classes. Each class is a coarse-grained history. For example, a class for the Earth went in a series of gates at a position at a series of times. And I need to measure the interference between the coarse-grained histories that felt when the interference vanishes. Predict probabilities and what the probabilities are. So the model I'm going to pick here, simplify the discussion, we'll just deal with finding formulation of quantum mechanics, if you like, in which the fine-grained histories, we'll just consider a bunch of particles in this box, and the fine-grained histories are are the paths of the particles in the box. X and T. And specify for all T's over some range. So that's the fine-grained description of the system. But the coarse-grained, as I said, there were partitions of the fine-grained histories into the class. So one very familiar type of partition is the partition the paths and the classes by ranges of position at a series of times. So we're interested in describing Earth's orbit. For example, we'd like to know that the center of mass was in this range. At this time, what's the probability of that range at that time, and so on. So that's a very familiar sort of the in tradition histories and all those that go through these ranges of position, those times, that's a little bundle of histories that constitutes Klein Grand, the coarse grained history. For each coarse grained history, you can construct a branch state vector, alpha refers to a particular coarse grained history, particular class of fine grained history, just by summing over paths, following prime, and giving the positive action divided by h bar, and letting that operate in the initial state. For those of you who like operators better, that's exactly the same as the Heisenberg picture expression, where you have a series of projections down one of those ranges of time. Well, in the initial state, now I have to give the third ingredient. I define fine grained history, coarse grained. And now the third ingredient is the measure of interference. So we have an initial state sign, we have branch state vectors for each history, and so-called decoherence function, which is the overlap of these two branches, is the natural measure of interference. So a set of histories is said to decohere, but the interference vanishes. When this is negligible, the orthogonal elements, basically it says the branch state vectors are perpendicular, and decoherence ensures the consistency of the probabilities, which are just squares of the branch state vectors. That's it. That's the whole process of prediction. Unless we didn't mention measurement, observers, anything in this construction. Decoherence is, of course, widespread in the universe, in our particular universe. For example, in the classic example of Yost would say, if you have a dust grain, this is one dust grain in superposition of two positions, let's say millimeter apart, deep in intergalactic space, about as isolated as you can get in a natural situation, then the 10 to the 11th black body photons that scatter off of it every second, right, effectively carry away the phase coherence between the superpositions on the time scale of a nanosecond. So as every experimentalist can tell you, right, it's hard to control phase information. So measurements and observers can of course be described in this theory, but are not fundamental notion to the quantum theory. Thus, for example, we can assign probabilities to the moon when nobody is looking at it, or to density fluctuations in the universe. And then we're conservative apparatus measure. So this is a generalization of the usual quantum theory, still keeping the space-time fixed. So that the usual theory of measurements that you should put in accumulation is what we call emergent from this theory. This theory is restricted to types of histories that actually describe measurement situations. Okay, that's my little review. I should ask for questions, all non-philosophical questions, please.
Thanks very much. You said that the experimentalists will tell you that this is too small, but the qualification is that the experimentalists will tell you it's too small today. We don't know what will happen 50 years from now.
Fair enough. And the budget's breach. Any other questions about this formulation or anything else? Crucial rest of the talking. Okay.
Well, maybe one question. Yeah. I don't know. What about the individual case? So suppose I measure a spin once, spin is out, I find the spin is out. You have been talking about probabilities mostly. So what is there such a thing as an individual case in your theory?
It's all individual cases. But we're getting probabilities for the individual cases.
You could imagine dynamics where the set of decoherent histories is very small.
Where the set of probabilities. Well, yeah. That's exactly what we get in the Keplerian orbit, right, situation. There we have one individual case, the Earth going around the Sun, and we have probabilities for high probabilities for given high condition probabilities, I should say, given a few positions in the Earth. That it will then fall around but that's the origin of classical determinism within the quantum
mechanics. You think about the opposite case, where the system is very quantum confused, so
yeah.
Several
Then there would be a large number with highly distributed probability.
So the usefulness of this approach depends on the system. As you, it would be.
Well, I would say this is a general approach that applies to all systems, and therefore it would be useful in all cases. Whether it is, whether approximations to this Lagrangian framework are an approximation which we can stop, of course, is, can be true for all measurement situations. So that's the approximation. But we're talking about cosmology. Okay? Good. Okay. Now, notice that this formulation of quantum mechanics that I gave you is a fully four-dimensional one in terms of pattern. So fine-grained histories were caused in space-time. The coarse graining was in terms of four-dimensional partitions of those histories, and the decoherence functional was constructed by a four-dimensional functional interval. But as Feynman showed in 1948, it can be connected to a formulation of quantum mechanics in terms of states on space-like surfaces and their unitary evolution. So here's a rough cartoon version of his demonstration. We start with the amplitude, for example, to propagate in a certain interval of time, which is the next double time, which is the sum of all paths that connect those two points. That can be factored, right, in as follows. First, consider the paths that go from x prime to some point x on an intermediate surface, and then from x on to x double prime. You can sum over all the paths that go from x prime to x, for example, from x on to x double prime, and then later sum over all x. And I think it's obvious that you will reproduce this sum over all the possible histories, because there's only one value of x that the path can have on this intermediate surface. I translated it into formalism. This tells you that the amplitude to go from A to B to times can be factored in terms of the interval of x of A to x, x to B, B, and this defines a wave function on the surface T. This defines another one, right? And they each evolve, right, according to their prior construction, according to some initial state, and then moved along in time by the path interval, and this satisfies the Schrödinger equation. So thus you recover, right, from the sum of Heisenberg's formulation, the Schrödinger equation, and you also recover back from the factorization, inner product, which means from the four-dimensional formulation, you effectively recover what in GR we can call the 3 plus 1 formulation of quantum mechanics. But note that equivalence, this factorization, required a few things. It certainly required a fixed space-time geometry, because that's what we did. That it be foldable, there actually be space-like surfaces that interpolated through which the state can evolve. And most importantly, it required that the histories be single-valued on these surfaces, so there was only one x each path intersected. That's true for fields, because fields are also single-valued on space-time. And it required for discussion of the alternatives, positions at different times, the alternatives are at definite moments of time to calculate the probability of these four positions. But we can expect none of that in quantum gravity fixing. So the usual quantum mechanics evolving through space-like surfaces, 3+1 formulation, has to be generalized to apply when space-time is not fixed, it's not foldable by space-like surfaces, when the histories are not single-valued in time, and when the alternatives are not fixed moments of time. And the four-dimensional formulation of quantum mechanics applies to point-time generalization. So it's that generalization that we're talking about at this moment. And there's a general framework which is extracted from the quantum mechanics of a system called generalized quantum theory. Right, which allows us to construct a class of generalizations, including this one, which is the Gell-Mann, Eichenblum, and Alloa, and various other people. Right, and it goes as follows. It has the same three elements we had in the ordinary quantum mechanics. Fine-grained histories, paths, parasitic particles, you know, four-dimensional field configurations for fields. Coarse grains, again, are partitions of the four-dimensional histories into classes. But the notion of what's the notion of interference can be characterized more abstract than we've done so far. And where you have a decoherence functional, which measures the interference between different coarse grain histories in the set, or as you'll see in a moment, all it needs to be is remission, in this sense, positive in the diagonal elements, normalized, and most importantly, it obeys the principle of superposition, which means if you take a coarse grain set of histories and divide it up into coarser grain classes, then the decoherence functional in the coarser grain classes should be the delta sum over histories in the finer grain classes that are in those coarse grain classes. So that's a sort of axiomatic characterization. And that is essentially what one needs in order to implement such a theory. You need a decoherence condition such as one we had, the off-diagonal elements vanish. When you do that, then the probabilities of the diagonal elements are the square of these. And as a consequence of those four requirements, these numbers p that are defined in this way are probabilities that they are between 0 and 1, and they satisfy the most general form of probability summers, namely, right, the probability of a coarser grain set is the sum of probabilities.
Can we elaborate on the coarse grain procedure?
Well, there's just a general notion of coarse grain. You take any positive finite history being partitioned in classes.
Or do you want?
Well, so usually in quantum theory, we would have
some. Maybe you would like to present a partition by the values of field averages regions. Or you might feel partition it by whether the fields have certain definite configurations on succession.
It's not important. The details of the coarse grain procedures are not important for your
The details of the coarse grain universe are everything, right? I mean, as far as making predictions, because that tells you what you're predicting about. They're not sort of, I wouldn't say that to characterize it that way would be misleading, say it's not important. When is the theory gives you all possible constraints? You get it. It's no different from describing what measurements you'd like to carry out in the system. Quantum theory gives you all possible measurements, and you pick which ones you realize I could also calculate the probabilities for. Okay, so familiar quantum mechanics, as I illustrated in the early part of the talk, is not the only way of satisfying these axioms. Now, there have been a lot of examples of this, but I think I'll just quote one to illustrate this connection. Space-time. Suppose your space-time is fixed, the geometry is fixed, but it has closed kind of like curves. So you can go around and around here like this. It's very easy to produce examples of that. Quantum mechanics is not going to work in a 2 plus 1 form, because there's no foliating family of space-like surfaces that takes you between here and there. So I can't sort of evolve in the Hamiltonian. But the space-time approach is okay. You can define histories as fields on this, partition the fields into classes, say by the value of the field here, the value of the field there, and you can do a kind of best matrix through this. And then you can define the branch state vectors as some of the fields in those classes. And this was carried out in perturbation theory by Friedman and Simon Papastamanu a bunch of years ago. The resulting theory is not very pleasant. It's acausal, right? Non-unitary, it's various things which one might not like. But it exists. So if we have such anomalies in space-time, we don't have to fall on our hands because there's no foliating family of space-like surfaces. This is more general thing. Okay, now I'd like to talk a little bit about gravity.
Yeah. No, I'll say it again.
Okay. Is it good or bad? I want to know when to head for the door. All I'm not going to outline a similar thing for quantum theory of space-time. Now, there are lots of quantum theories of space-time, especially in this instance. I'm not going to commit to any one of them. Right? Rather, I'm going to discuss the theory in the context of the low-energy effective theory, namely Einstein's theory of space-time geometry, cut off sounds appropriate as far as the divergences are concerned. That sort of supplies a model for the quantum, kind of quantum kinematics I'm talking about. Other situations. And so the key idea in making this generalization is that the histories of the subject don't have to represent evolution in space. This is the producer that he was in fields and things, but they can represent the evolution of space time. So the histories, in this case, would be four dimensional geometries. One of the things I hope to find out here in the Perimeter Institute is just exactly in the various quantum theories of gravity that you're working on. For example, in loop quantum gravity, maybe the histories are the histories of spin functions of a certain kind. And I want to find out just whether people expected it out, for example, classical space-time is to force ranging of these spin functions. We've got sort of just interviewed a bunch of people, right? And sometimes they say yes, and sometimes they say no, sometimes they say it's not defined, but I'll try and find out what the answers are here. String theory, presumably there are histories in the string field, post sets, the presumably histories of the causal connections between different points in the post sets, and so on. The idea is that this is a simple representation of a common set of problems. Well, I've got to tell you about what the three readings, the fine grain history, the coarse grainings, and the coherence function. So the fine grain histories, again, are four dimensional histories, four dimensional matter field configurations. The coarse grainings are partitions of these histories into classes. Now, any assertion that can be made, right, it's expressible in space time form, has defined such a partition. Because there's, most generally, there will be a class of histories for which the assertion is true, and there's a class of histories for which it's false. And that divides at least the class of proposed histories into two parts. If you can't divide it into two parts, arguably the question doesn't make much sense. An example is the question of, does the universe reach a certain maximum volume in the course of its history? That's the same question as exactly in four-dimensional language, as asking whether the four-dimensional geometry is a space-like surface with a volume bigger than some fiducial volume or not. That's not a question which is at any one moment of time. Right? It's a question that has to deal with the whole histories. And we expect, in quantum gravity, that all such questions will be of that form. So these, in some sense, are the observables of quantum gravity, these four-dimensional partitions. We don't expect to find local ones, because there is no diffeomorphism invariant. So locality, although we could find, as many people have discussed here and elsewhere, these kind of relational partitions of the past, right, in which one thing is connected to some other thing in a diffeomorphism invariant way. The decoherence function is constructed in much the same way. Psi alpha is the sum of all the four-dimensional geometries in this class, acting on the initial condition of the universe. The decoherence function is the overlap in some case, I don't want to go into the details here, constructed by, say, the reduced in the crack for those experiments. Well, that's a four-dimensional formulation of the low-energy quantum theory of gravity. But we can now ask the question, does it have an equivalent 3 plus 1 formulation in terms of states of volume for space-like surface? And the answer seems to be no. It does not have such a formulation. The reason is because, as we argued, in order to have Feynman's factorization, the histories had to be single-valued in some variable. But we don't expect there to be one variable, for example, defining a space like a surface, it traces the extrinsic curvature, that occurs once and only once in every space-time. That's true, perhaps, in certain classical space-times of the Einstein equations, but there's no reason to expect that you couldn't construct examples of, say, a surface of constant extrinsic curvature zero time arbitrarily in space. So since the history don't move forward, they can't be factored in that you don't expect to find a 3 plus 1. What is a 3 greater than 3 plus 1 if? And yet the theory, like the theory of the post-time of curves, is generally predicted. So where then does ordinary quantum mechanics come from in this 3 plus 1 formulation? The answer is that you recover states approximately when the geometry behaves classically and can define the space-like surfaces through which the states evolve. So one equation will serve to illustrate this. Here's our branch state vector, which is the sum of the four geometries in matter fields. Let's suppose we're dealing with a coarse grain, such that, just for the sake of example, such that this integral over the geometries is well approximated in the semi-classical plane, as would be the situation with a coarse grain, find the semi-classical term, for which only one geometry is fixed, then this is a solution of the Einstein equation to semi-classical geometry, and the resulting integral defines field theory in that geometry, quantum field theory in that classical geometry. Then, of course, since the fields are single value in the space-time, you can recover the usual story. You have a causal structure, a notion of time, states on space-like surfaces, and a Schrodinger equation. So this way of looking at quantum mechanics, the familiar Hamiltonian quantum mechanics with its preferred times emerges not generally in the universe, but as an approximation that is appropriate for a particular physical situation in the late universe, appropriate when those initial conditions imply classical space-time integral with approximation in a more general sum over histories formulation of quantum cosmology that's free from any need to pick out a particular time.
I have a question here. At that point, is there a condition on the state or something like that such that that emergent approximate theory on the space-time is unitary?
I think the unitarity follows pretty much from the categorical construction, that it just is a different finding. Now, I guess how closely am I examining that? I've just done formal. So just as Feynman showed that the path integral from one surface to another of a particle wound up being something that satisfies the Schrodinger equation, so I expect that to be true for the unitarity of the classical field. Well, but all this has been a discussion of generalizing quantum mechanics to the case where space-time exists, but it's partially. What if there's no space-time? Many pioneers, especially here, we can still have a generalized quantum mechanics in principle, since they're all very bizarre and can't construct it for you. But as long as you have a situation where you have a completely fine-grained description, a notion of coarse grain and a measure of interference between the alternatives, then you can construct a generalized quantum mechanics and ask what emerges from a particular approximation. In other words, generalized quantum theory by itself, just thinking a particular representation of an exhibit to, doesn't require space and time. And I mentioned, I talked about various things being emergent, and since this isn't the Santa Fe Institute, I'm allowed to do that here. But let me try and define a little more closely what I mean by that. We're used to the notion of an effective field theory, which in the present context, when we're reading the following, you have some fundamental theory which has its own coherence function. You have an effective coherence function, which works like this. Every history of the effective theory is also a history of the fundamental theory. And it's true, there's an approximate equality for these two, only for a limited class of coarse grains and specific histories, which describe whatever the emerging phenomena are. So, for example, we have various examples of this. One is effective field theory, for example, in many contexts in particle physics, the quasi-classical realm of everyday experience. It's not a general property of quantum mechanics, but it's an emergent feature in the sense that the quantum mechanics of our universe, for sufficiently coarse-grained descriptions that we're used to every day, a quantum mechanics of measurement states on space-like surfaces, right, is not a general property of the system, but is emergent for those histories that actually describe measurement situation and sufficiently coarse-grained geometry of classical space-time, and after all, we believe the chemistry, geology, and human history are just effective theories, right, that are emergent sources in quantum mechanics. Let me give you a simple example of emergence, which is very cute, which is the emergence of a number of time dimensions in the theory of wave function of the universe. Talking from boundary proposals. So this is a very simple model, but it illustrates how, in some ways, how things go. We have a wave function, right, which is going to be a theory of initial condition of cosmology, which in the no boundary proposals wouldn't. I'm just going to make a simple model for the matter where I just have metric and cosmological constant, that's all. So we integrate over all the geometries, the Euclidean action, right, of all geometries which have one boundary, right, which the U3 metric matches the argument of the wave function, and they have no other boundary. Then semi-classically, this is approximated in WKB form, we predict classical geometry. So let's ask for semi-classical geometries that end in a large, meaning large compared to one of the cosmological constants, square root of that, surface that's sufficiently symmetric, homogeneous, and isotropic. And so we'll look for the steepest sense approximation to this wave function. There isn't any pure Euclidean sum here. Because the Euclidean geometry is a force field, this is in fact raised the cosmological constant, so it can't get big enough. But there is a so-called real Tomlin geometry, which is Euclidean down here, right, that is at small geometries and then expands in the Lorentzian section, which matches on. This is a solution, if you like, of the Einstein equations. You've got to match carefully across here, which means in the matching conditions of general relativity, it has to be totally geodesic. So it's a curvature set that vanishes in a little sign, and the HIJ have to match. So you can ask, what kind of geometries can you expect up here? Well, they can't be Euclidean, as I've already said. Could they have, well, you can match a Lorentzian geometry onto this with one time direction. Could you match a geometry with two time directions in it? Well, the answer is no, because it wouldn't fit across this geometry. Down here, on one side, you use geometry with the space line, and from the top, it would have that one time direction that lay in the surface. So here's an example where, from the theory of the initial condition, right, the single time in space time emerges from space time, for example. So as I said, we've had several examples of fields emerging in reflective field theories. And you can sort of organize them in two different ways. You can look at the process of starting with a theory and then commonize and then generalize in more general perspectives and thereby achieve some power. Or you can look at the process of reflective field theories as making restrictions, which is you get more and more specific theories. Those two things are in some sense the inverse of one another. To generalize a theory, you very typically have to get rid of some idea, because the theory rely on particular circumstances, right, that where the ideas were not false, they were true, but they only resulted from a limited perspective because of our limited range of observations and our limited experience. For example, Copernicus, we had a theory in which it looked like the Earth went around, the sun went around the Earth, right, from a limited range of experience on the surface, but if you take a more general perspective, that idea was excess baggage, and we had to get rid of it. 19th century people believed that the second law of thermodynamics was exact. That idea was excess baggage. In a more general perspective arising from statistical mechanics, we had to get rid of that. It wasn't false, it wasn't finding increases, but it was not an absolute idea. It was a result in a particular limited range of observation. So here's some of the things which we talked about in this book. Organized in this fashion. So this is a bunch of theories, starting down here in classical physics, moving up to the usual formulation of quantum mechanics, which are Golden quarks and quantum mechanics of measured subsystems, to classical spacetime and quantum matter, which is the theory I discussed in the beginning, and closed systems and quantum spacetime and matter, discussed in the structure meeting, and those sorts of at the top here. So you can, this is a direction of generalization, and this is a direction more specific. This direction is the direction of emergence, where particular phenomena emerge from a more general framework because of the special situations. While this is the direction of getting rid of excess baggage. So as we are moving upwards, it's a bit easier. We moved up from classical physics to quantum mechanics, we had to get rid of the idea of determinism. As we moved up from the approximation of quantum mechanics and measured subsystems, we had to get rid of the notion of the quasi-classical realm as fundamental measurements and subsystems and so forth. And as we moved up from that to where we had classical space-time generalizations, the generalization I described first part of the talk, classical space-time quantum matter, as we moved up from that, but the space-time be classical, we had to get rid of the idea of states of space-time surfaces. And if we're going to move up and get rid of the idea of space-time and histories, we want to require some further generalization. Correspondingly, moving downward is the restrictive theory. We recover in the restrictions these more specific notions. But in this process of moving upward, we're left with a somewhat peculiar place, I think. Because you have to ask why in quantum mechanics? The founders of quantum theory thought that the indeterminacy of quantum theory arose from an inevitable disturbance of measurement dictated by the magnitude of the quantum reactions. But what's the origin of quantum indeterminacy in a theory that seeks to describe the whole universe? There is nothing outside of it to measure, carry out such a measure. Why enforce the principle of superposition when there's only one state in the state of the whole universe? In short, we have to ask the question, will quantum mechanics itself need to be discarded as we move out of this? And then I put two question marks up for that. Is it itself a notion of excess baggage? Well, I don't know, and I can't think of any better way of ending the question to repeat what I said at the beginning. Does quantum mechanics apply to space time? Yes, provided it's certainly generalized. Thank you.
In the case of applying the general formalism to a system where there is a time, the chain of histories were defined by projection operators at specific times. So when this is applied to quantum gravity, how does one go about doing a course training? You no longer have keys to times.
Well, I think this is some of the reasons for the notion. The course training just means dividing the four-dimensional histories and field configurations in the classes. Not on the space time surface, of course, they're not sequences or projections anymore. But the operators in principle could be fine. Since I haven't exhibited a really precise theory, it's difficult to do it. So the notion of sequences of projections is something that's intrinsic to theory of time. But even that is not general, even that's not completely general in ordinary quantum mechanics. In fact, even in the quantum mechanics of measurement, people typically describe these projections at one moment of time, but what moment of time are they talking about? Do you think a measurement is defined to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 42 seconds? I don't think so. It's extended over time. And for that reason, the real general situation in ordinary quantum mechanics, where there's called space-time alternatives. They're extended over ranges of time. And those things are not represented by projections in the theory, but by abstractions such as described here, even in the nanomaterials theory.
I'm puzzled by a word analyzed, just as I was puzzled yesterday. It's terminology which suggests that this is a general theory, which immediately suggests that it should be tested with respect to more special
theory. I just meant it included the other theory in this certain limited case.
But this, in history of physics, whenever more specific theory is included in more general theory, there has been some test to check whether this idea, generalized idea is true or not, or even worth pursuing.
Fair enough. But if we don't have such a generalization, we can't even begin to investigate the question. So that's what stage I'm at. I think that the theory, the measurement approximation, is an excellent approximation for all measurements that we're carrying out. But we talk about the possibility that there's something that's exploitable that's not considered here. Certainly, for example, the space-time alternatives that I just described, we're in a logistic phenomenon. That have been discussed for common times and so forth. But we have very little data.
So this is a general framework at this stage. Mm-hmm. And also, do you want a particular.
Oh, I wanted to mention one of the things I'm also here for is to find out what understands quantum theory of gravity gets into this
general. Maybe you'll sit into the So but my question was, so this is a general framework rather than a particular theory that's at this stage. In order to narrow down on a particular theory, you need some idea on how to do it. So the best way to do it would be to import some principles that enter the theory, such as the principle of equivalence. Do you have any ideas how to go about that?
I'm more of a cosmologist than anything else, so I'm concerned with the low energy phenomenon of the universe, such as the galaxy correlation function. And I proceed on the function, on the assumption, guaranteed from on high, that if I deal with low energy quantum theory, for example, an adequate theory of the initial condition, it would be tested. So if I was doing it, I would take a cutoff version of general relativity. Right, which the simplest example is, for example, Regian calculus, where you take everything to be discrete, and the histories are represented by triangulations, where they're defined by the edges, and then the space of histories is the space of edges. We could proceed to calculate interesting partition given in theory of the initial condition. Alternatively, if people were already doing it, within what are called dynamical triangulations, which are keeping the triangles fixed, the simplicities fixed, and the triangle putting them together into different geometries because of topology. Or maybe perhaps might be possible to do spin bubbles or something like that. But I'm not such an expert on the general subject, so I'm hoping somebody else will.
Once you started discussing applying the quantum mechanics to space-time, you said, well, you have space-time and matter. Now, I would have thought in the philosophy of general relativity, they're sort of connected. But can you do quantum mechanics just on space-time without having any matter? And it's just a question of are there models?
It's true. I was using the general relativistic terminology, which is a distinguished geometry, and all the other fields are called that.
Yeah.
So, in principle, of course, we can have gravitational waves, classic, which are geometry without matter of any kind. And so we could have quantum mechanics of such situations. Indeed, the one I illustrated in the last one was just of that character. So there's no obstacle to doing it, though we aim at the realistic theory of the universe, where there's obviously other things besides the gravitational one, so we shouldn't be restricted.
So there are models where you can do just space time and no matter.
They're already possible. I mean, just gravity wave theory or the scorcher of black hole is an example. It's no matter. It's all geometry.
Yeah. I just want to make sure we get it seems that in your mechanical picture of the history of space time, you didn't include the change of topology of the universe.
Could include the change of the topology. In the first picture, I drew a little hand mark.
Yes, one question. How do you find exactly that the observed models of the decoherence function are vanished? I mean, do they need to be exactly zero, or do they need to be in your final theory approximately zero? And in that case, what do you define as approximately zero?
Realistic situations that are approximately zero, and you can set the level of approximation. For example, going between the theory I described in the Copenhagen approximation. Copenhagen approximation, at least as I estimated in discrete figures of error, like 10 to the minus 10 to 50. So that's a really small number, and you can allow stop and probabilities of that consideration. But there's an intrinsic sort of, if physics made only predictions of things that exist with probability 1, there would be very little that we could do in the world. So usually, for example, an experimentalist with statistics, right, they are multiplying the size of the system in an effort to drive down the fluctuation. How low do they have to go? And they don't go to zero in the fluctuation. It could be that every result is the result of some statistical fluctuation of the input. Well, typically, it's a sociological question. It depends on what the competing theories are, how far you have to go to distinguish one from the other. Well, it's a similar thing here. The theory is that it's right yesterday. You can do a whole lot that you want to make for probabilities exact by the basis called linear positivity. But let's not go there.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Well, Jim is
here. Explain the whole universe and those all the questions I can.
No. Now I'm going to
be. No, it's real question. That's right. You didn't disappear.
Yeah. And I think there have been enough interesting questions. I'll stay fine. Jim is here for the rest of the week this time, and so we have less time to talk to him, and that's thank him again.